oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education. And because of COVID-19 and safety, we are not taping this from the studio. So Dan and I and our guest are all taping remotely.
Well, Dr. Remote Pope,
yeah.
Here we are.
Yes, we are remote.
Right. So I've been pretty unhappy about the amount of attention that schools didn't get early on, where there was very, very difficult policy, wasn't enough research focused on it, and it kind of continues.
When you say early on, you mean March?
Sorry, yes. Early in the pandemic, when they were putting yellow tape around young children's playgrounds, and then they started opening up things, and they left the yellow tape on the playgrounds. And I sort of felt like that's what they were doing with schools, that they really hadn't thought deeply about it, even though, you know, parents are going crazy, kids are, you know, not getting to see their friends and all the things that school does for you. During the political season, we didn't hear a lot about schools from our candidates. You know, now it's finally gotten people's attention because they're starting to open up. So, Denise, this is an easy question for you.
Oh, no. It never is from you, Dan.
No, I think this one's easy. You're going to have like 43 answers.
Oh.
So California has released a dashboard that shows openings of private schools, charter schools, and public schools. And it breaks it out by elementary, middle, and high school. And when you look at it, what you see is that private schools are opening up for in-person instruction and hybrid instruction at a much greater rate than public schools and then charter schools. So why is that, Denise? Let me say it again. Private schools are opening it up at a faster rate than public institutions. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of different reasons, right? So
I'm counting up to 43.
Okay. Well, one of the things that we know about private schools is that they don't have to deal with unions for the most part. They can make decisions pretty quickly. They don't have to go and wait for a school board vote. So even in my own work, we find that making changes at private schools are pretty nimble. They're pretty fast. So that's one reason, is that they were able to kind of mobilize. Another reason is that they tend to be smaller. And so it's easier to space kids out because you have fewer kids overall in the private schools to meet that sort of 6 feet apart with masks kind of thing. I also know that many private schools are extremely well-resourced, often more well-resourced than the public schools in the area. So they were able to put up cameras, they were able to put up HVAC ventilation, they were able to put up tents to keep kids outside and learning and meet those space requirements. I know some schools that have their own very good testing and contact tracing built in. I know a school that paid for teachers to get vaccinated, and that's not even, you know, I don't even know how they did that, because technically, you know, I don't even know how they got vaccines. So private schools are more nimble. They were faster to jump on this. There's a lot fewer hoops that they have to jump through. Even just right away applying for emergency allowance to have kids on campus, which is what you had to do by county. My private school principals, who I've been in touch with, were like the first in, when it was a pretty complicated form and process that you had to go through to get this emergency allowance. And the public schools, it's a lot harder, a lot more complicated.
Right.
Was that 42 or 43? Did I make it?
It was one. It was one long run-on sentence.
It's hard.
No, that was good. So we're lucky today to have someone who's on the front lines of this. This is Professor Bill Kosky. He's at the Stanford Law School, and he specializes in legal matters relating to children, particularly those with disabilities. But he's been following the legal issues surrounding school reopening. So thank you, Bill. It's good to see you.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. We've had Bill before.
Yes,
welcome
we have.
Back to the show.
Back by popular demand.
Yes.
That was fun.
Teachers get vaccinated and everybody reopens or no?
Well, I think the answer is pretty self-evident that that's not necessarily the final answer. Although getting teachers vaccinated will go a long way toward making schools open. And that may be perhaps the one thing that could that everybody agrees on would open the doors to schools very, very quickly. And as we know in California, after people who are 65 and older, it appears that people who have underlying conditions and disabilities, and it looks like teachers will be next on the list. And could be within a matter of weeks that we'll see teachers getting vaccinated. Some have started in some of the counties, actually. And if you look at this issue across the United States, there are many, many school districts whose teachers are already fully vaccinated and back in doing in-person instruction.
And the reason vaccination will work is because the unions will say, okay, or the teachers will say, okay.
Yeah. And you know, be characterized as an issue of the teachers' unions versus reopening is, you know, a little oversimplified because I think, you know, administrators as well want to make sure that getting kids safely back into school is a priority. I know that parents as well want to make sure that their schools are safe before they'll send their kids back. And even where we see school districts open for in-person instruction, parents are often given the opportunity or the option to leave their kids at home, particularly if, you know, folks at home are immunocompromised or somehow more likely to get sick if they do get the virus. But, you know, some teachers' unions have made vaccination a condition for reopening. In San Francisco Unified, for instance, as long as the school district remains in, I'm going to get into color coding here, you know, the various tiers here, as long as the school district doesn't go below the red tier, vaccines are going to be mandatory, according to the teachers' union. Now, if San Francisco's rates go down even further, so they go into orange tier and below, they may open up without vaccines. But right now, the unions have made it pretty clear that vaccines are almost a prerequisite to opening, because we're a long way away from getting down to the orange tier.
And Bill, I read that even when you have the majority of your teachers vaccinated, there's still going to be teachers who fear for their kids, particularly I would say at adolescents, right? Because they know that high school students can spread the virus just as easily, we think, as adults. So even though the teachers are vaccinated, bringing the kids back is a worry for teachers who worry about their students and who worry about the students' families. What do you know about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, you raised the issue of age levels here, and that has been front and center in this conversation. As we know, elementary schools in parts of the country have been open since September. And I, for one, have a nephew who's a kindergartner, and he's been happily going to school in person since September. When you get to middle school and especially high schools with adolescents, it's a much more difficult proposition because, you know, kids who are together are going to be social. They're not necessarily going to practice social distancing and follow the rules. That's the nature of being a teenager. And on top of that, we don't know a lot about vaccines and teenagers yet. There hasn't been a lot of testing and trials on teenagers, to my knowledge, and it's not clear at all what the vaccination will mean for teenagers and whether or not it would stop the spread.
Yeah. So in a really depressing scenario, and then we'll get happy because I don't want to depress our listeners like this. I was told since the vaccine wasn't tested in normal circumstances, it was only tested with people wearing masks at 6 feet away, that some schools are even saying next September, even if you get all the adults vaccinated, until all the students are vaccinated, they may not come back. That utterly depressed me.
I don't even want to think about that scenario. I'm anxious to get back in the classroom too.
So, but what is the legal obligation of schools to the families, right? So my kid goes to school, he increases the chances he gets something and brings it back to the family. Does the school carry a burden around that?
So early on in the pandemic, there was pressure from schools as well as businesses, I should add, to create liability shields, to have the legislatures actually say, if people get sick, the institutions, the schools, the businesses, whatever, would not be liable. The truth is the liability shields went nowhere, and school districts theoretically could be held liable, but they would have to have awfully negligent or reckless behavior. So if they were following public health guidance with social distancing and masking, you know, contact tracing and what have you, that would be enough for them to not be found negligent. So my view is that concern was wiped away pretty early on in the pandemic. The fear of mass liability for schools and administrators, unless, of course, they're being reckless or negligent with student health.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking today with Bill Kosky, who is an expert on the legality of the education system from the Stanford Law School, talking about how to reopen schools safely and, I guess, legally. Go ahead.
Stanford was planning to bring students back, and then we went into a tier where the level of infection was pretty high in the county. And so the county put in place, you know, a set of rules that it turned out those rules were so severe, and not in a bad way, they were just severe, that we actually couldn't bring the students back because they would basically not be able to see each other. You could only put a few kids into a classroom. School districts, how do they accommodate these high demands for mass? You know, even if the teachers are vaccinated, kids have to be a certain distance, HVAC.
Right. So public health administrators obviously have the final say in all of this. They can say, here are the bare minimum rules that you need to comply with in order to reopen schools. And in fact, there have been times in the Bay Area here where the stringent rules coming from public health officers have made it impossible for schools to reopen. For instance, it would be almost impossible right now to get high school reopened because of the very stringent demands that are being made by public health administrators. So that's true. That said, there is, you know, ways to get schools open safely. There are guidelines and guidance for that. Schools have been open for, you know, even in the San Francisco Bay Area, which has pretty strict rules around public health, schools have been open for a long time, especially at the elementary level, in compliance with whatever public health orders exist.
So can I, this is really naive, but I just want to, the decision-making process, sort of the state trumps the county and the county trumps the school district and the school district trumps the principal. Or the parents trump the principal, where are these decisions getting made? Is it basically the school says, I've got all these things around me and I follow the county?
Yeah, that's both the beauty and the bane of diffused governance that we have in the United States and in a place like California, right? I mean, the state ultimately and the legislature does have plenary power around issuing guidance, either requiring opening of schools or giving rules for when schools can be open and the like. That said, you know, they've left a lot of it up to local public health administrators with regard to all kinds of different openings of businesses, of course, and of schools. And then the school districts themselves are getting pressured from parents and communities, getting pressured as on the other end, potentially from teachers' unions. They feel a bit whipsawed, I believe. And at the same time, they might point fingers. And there might be times when they can actually open up schools safely, but are choosing to point fingers at folks who don't have the power to necessarily keep the schools closed. And that's at the heart of a battle that's going on in San Francisco right now. There seems to be a lot of finger pointing going on as to who is preventing schools from being open, to the point where it's led to litigation, which is a rather unusual move, but has happened. And this litigation has taken several different forms, and we could talk about that.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking with Bill Kosky about the legalities of reopening schools. And I think we should mention, just because it is so unusual, this lawsuit in San Francisco, compared to how schools are run in other cities where there's mayoral control. So, Bill, walk us through that.
Yeah, so, the specter of litigation has been out there since the beginning of the pandemic. As you all know, for children with disabilities, they have a right to a free and appropriate public education. And neither the Department of Education nor Congress waived that obligation for school districts to provide kids with an adequate education. And so since the beginning of the pandemic, there has always been the threat that parents and families of children with disabilities could sue to have their kids be provided in-person instruction or appropriate instruction. And some things can't be done from a distance, occupational therapy, for instance, right? And so these lawsuits have been brought from time to time, including a very large one that was filed in Los Angeles directly with the California Supreme Court. That case was never pursued by the California Supreme Court, but the thinking was is that LA Unified had to provide in-person instruction for kids with disabilities in order to provide them with the FAPE. Similarly, we've had a lawsuit against the state of California for its failure to provide the money and the resources to ensure that all kids, particularly low-income kids, particularly communities of color, are provided with an open schoolhouse door. That lawsuit is still going on. But the San Francisco one takes the cake. This is the city of San Francisco has sued its own school district. And what's interesting about San Francisco is the boundaries of the city are the boundaries of the county are the boundaries of the school district. And so we have competing political bodies here. And the city attorney and the mayor have been very vocal about making sure that the schools get open. And the school district has not put in place any plans, any meaningful plans to reopen the schools. 52,000 kids in SFUSD have not been in school since the beginning of the pandemic, whereas about 15,000 kids in private and charter schools in San Francisco have. So it seems unfair. The city attorney decided to file a lawsuit against this school board to get the schools reopened. And needless to say, the fireworks have gone off.
But so as a parent, they've had 12 months. This is not like in March or April where it was just thrust upon us. And I think a lot of parents were like, okay, you know, we wish it was going to be shorter, but we get it. We're going to get to the summer and then it's going to be normal. And then fall came and nope, we're not open. And then January came and nope, we're not open. How many months? I mean, I think it's fair for a parent to say, how many months do you need to come up with a safe plan?
Yeah, families are hurting right now. There's no question about that. Families with young children are hurting, especially families that have to work, families who have very untenable and difficult living situations, access to internet, access to technology issues. That has all been a problem. So families are hurting and they are frustrated and they have a right to be mad at this point. And as we've seen in San Francisco, there have been marches and protests to try to get the schools reopened. And, you know, litigation is one avenue to maybe put this at the top of the agenda. I'm afraid it already is at the top of the agenda and it probably doesn't need a lawsuit to be there, although it is, something that has put some extra pressure on the district to reopen.
And just to sort of wrap this part up, nobody's mentioned the federal government. I mean, we actually have new leadership and we have a Center for Disease Control that just put out guidelines. But I have read that those are just guidelines and they don't trump, for lack of a better word, the state. So is that true, Bill? Can Biden say all schools must open and like we would have to follow?
Biden could not do that alone through executive order. That would not be possible. Congress could, through some very, very tortured legislative process, make it happen, but it's not going to happen. I have a different question for Congress. Where's the money? Mm-hmm. You know, it costs money to reopen schools. I have a different question for Sacramento. Where's the money? How come we haven't paid the same level of attention to getting schools reopened? And we can take that up as well.
All right, let's bring it on. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Bill Kosky and all the legal issues about reopening schools next on Sirius XM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope
from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Bill Kosky about all the legalities involved in opening schools safely and promptly.
So I have expressed my frustration. I think this is the show to just finally just get pissed off straight out. Right. Well, you're a superintendent and you're stuck trying to make these decisions where every other superintendent's also trying to make the decisions and you're all having to learn everything and go through the exact same mistakes, try and keep up with the science. The funding sources are confused. You don't know if you're going to get the money or not. You haven't decided. The teachers, the parents don't know what they want. It's utter chaos. Right. And why can't we just organize this? So one solution is, well, in a crisis, you really need a different kind of command structure, right? A distributed system may not be the right way to do it in a crisis. But Bill pointed a finger somewhere else. He says, no, there's not enough money. So Bill, Is it there's not enough money? It's the wrong command structure for a crisis, and that we should be more flexible and prepared for it. What? Just throw around some blame.
Get us out of this mess. Bill, solve the problem.
toss a little blame around, right? You know, I mentioned Congress when we put together our first relief act back in the spring. There wasn't a huge appropriation for schools. There should have been. And we're not talking about getting HVAC systems into place and that sort of thing, which costs money and takes time. We could have talked about that, but at a minimum, we should have talked about testing and contact tracing and making sure that, you know, people would feel safe sending their kids back to school, and the teachers who were healthy enough and wanted to could also go back to school and do some amount of teaching. We're about ready to do another, you know, large relief bill. Congress better, as they promised, do something big for schools. Now, Sacramento also tried to put some money into this, but it did hit some roadblocks, largely because a lot of the bigger urban districts felt like they would get shortchanged by the appropriation. It wasn't going to be enough to deal with some of the older infrastructure and some of the more dense buildings that we have in places like San Francisco and otherwise. But, you know, again, money would help. So there's blame. That's blame number one for sure.
Let's stick with finger pointing.
Okay.
So why didn't Congress put more money into education in the first bill?
I'm not a student of Congress, so I can't tell you what went on.
The public doesn't care enough that they can force their congressmen to do this?
We had a different administration at that time, an administration that was not willing to do the work necessary to move Congress in that direction. So that's why I'm hopeful that this administration can do that. So, you know, I'll play politics there. We didn't have an executive branch that would do anything other than tweet out, you know, open the school and not do anything else.
So this is good. We pointed a finger at the president. We pointed a finger at Congress. A little bit at Sacramento. Keep going, Bill. Keep pointing, man.
So your point about distributed leadership in this is a tricky issue, right? I mean, where we have seen deals cut in big urban school districts, there has been mayoral control. Mayor Lightfoot, just a couple of weeks ago, or a week and a half ago, finally hammered out a very contentious deal with the Chicago Teachers Association to get Chicago schools open. And that's a monumental task to get Chicago schools open because they're, you know, those schools are old, they're vertical, they're dense, it's cold, there's not a lot of outside space like we have in California. You know, so there's that is a very difficult public health project there. And yet the mayor was able to hammer that out. So there is something to say about having somebody who can just kind of take the reins in a crisis like this and get the job done. The other piece of this, of course, is that the complication of individual teachers and the teachers' fears and concerns and the way that they're working their butts off right now doing distance learning and not being recognized for it. I think, you know, the persons of the year should be teachers because parents have finally realized how important teachers are. As individuals, they're very diverse on this subject. You know, we all know teachers who want to get back in the classroom right now and are not very risk averse. They just want to go ahead and get in the classroom and teach. There are others who are sick or could be sick and don't want to go in the classroom. But collectively, this is how, you know, unions work, is that they have to protect everybody. An injury to one is an injury to all, so to speak, you know, the old way of thinking about it. And they have to make sure, they have the obligation to make sure that their membership is represented well. That creates a very, very difficult situation to negotiate to get the doors open. So, you know, money would help, leadership would help, and finding some way to make teachers as a represented unit feel comfortable would help as well.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Bill Kosky about all the problems trying to reopen schools and placing blame on a bunch of different people.
So I feel better, Bill. This is
feel good.
Thank you. And then I remind myself, it is a pandemic, right? It is a pandemic. And so we're not prepared for this kind of thing. And everybody's doing the best they can.
Yeah.
But for just a moment, it was really nice to blame everyone.
Well, so, and I think
that except for the teachers,
it's the comparison thing, though. If we didn't have states who had kids, you know, my nephews and nieces have been going to school pretty much every day, full time in Florida. And you can say what you want about Florida, but they've been going, and sometimes they have to close. These are high schoolers, by the way. Sometimes they have to close, but for the most part, they are going. And when I see the mental health issues going on with adolescents and the need for them to not be isolated, and how many child abuse issues are going untraced because teachers don't have eyes on kids, and, you know, I don't wish to be in Florida necessarily, but like it's the comparison. I think if everybody was in the same boat, I'd buy the, it's a pandemic, let's be patient. You know, we're doing the best we can, but we're not.
But 5 months ago, you would have criticized Florida for being so risky to open up.
No, totally. But now that we see Tennessee and Florida and Texas, which I know are sort of red states, and this is why they are open, seeing that they are for the most part working in that sense, why can't we follow suit?
A place like the Bay Area has been pretty scrupulous about following public health orders in ways that Floridians don't necessarily. That's just a cultural political thing, right? And that matters. Yeah, sure, we feel envy of the Floridians who are sending their kids to school. I think we also have to feel envy of the families who are sending their kids to private schools right here in the Bay Area, as mm-hmm. we talked about already. Realistically, though, are schools going to be open in Los Angeles, in Oakland, and in San Francisco by the end of the year? I don't know. I could see elementary kids going back for, you know, part of the week. And I could possibly see, you know, some middle school kids. High schoolers are a whole different ballgame, as we already talked about. We will have done something very wrong if we're not open in September. That's all I can say.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I think every parent out there is saying even earlier, please. I saw a really bizarre comment from some educators saying, well, we're at March. Does it really make sense to go through all the work if it's just to be open for a few months? And every parent in America is screaming, yes, right? Yeah. Absolutely. 100%.
Are there legal issues with schools opening in the summer?
You mean extending the school year?
I mean, we basically lost last spring. So let's add another summer.
So the legal issues are the ones we would expect. There would have to be negotiations with the teachers unions to open up, you know, the schools in the summertime. There would have to probably be other kinds of facilities preparedness issues and the like, but that's doable. It does raise the issue, of course, of learning loss. And I'm worried about the long tail of the pandemic and how it's going to affect kids and learning. And we are going to probably need to double down on making sure that, you know, this lost year, not totally lost, but largely lost year, doesn't create ripple effects that are going to really harm kids, you know, deep into their academic lives. How can we get kids back on track and, you know, make sure that the tail isn't as long as it could be on this pandemic?
Thank you, Bill, for being here. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.